Welcome to the Winning with Shopify podcast. This is the podcast to help you scale your Shopify store into a money-making machine. Your host is Nick Truman. He's a Shopify expert and the CEO of JustAskParker.com, a global specialist marketing agency for Shopify owners. Nick will be sharing his knowledge and interviewing the experts to help you thrive and build a business that makes you money. For exclusive offers, bonus content, and weekly episode reminders, join our mailing list at winningwithshopify.com. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Here's your host, Nick Truman.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Winning with Shopify podcast. Anyone who's not tuned in before, welcome to the show. It's an absolute delight to have you here with us. My name's Nick, been hosting the show for a couple of years. If it's not your first time, you're either clicking the skip 30 seconds button and ignoring all of this, or you're just delighted to hear my voice. Either way, welcome back to the show. It's an absolute pleasure to have you tuning in as well. If you've not already, hit that subscribe button. It really helps us out to see how many people are subscribed. We watch all the viewer counts, and we also assess which episodes are most popular to try and make more content that is relevant to you guys as well. Final notice, I'm going to be saying this probably every week until the end of the year now, is we've filled a good chunk of our calendar next year for sponsors and themes and different topics we're covering each month. We're going to do a month on every topic next year. That is the plan at this stage. If you're interested in sponsoring or getting involved, or you want to come on as a speaker, a sponsor will be paying for that slot. So if you want to come on as a speaker, it would potentially be free as well. Go on our website, drop us a note, either in the form that's on the right-hand side, the form on the contact page, or go on the sponsor page and just fill it out saying, I don't want a sponsor, but I run a really successful store. And we want to hear from you guys, want to hear your problems. And if we can help with any of them live on the podcast, then fantastic news as well. Today, we're talking about quite an interesting topic, and it's something we've covered twice before with the same guest. So I'll introduce our guest first, then we'll talk about what we're talking about today. So without further ado, Ben Leonard, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here. We'll ask you to give us a bit of a background in a second, Ben, because we get a lot of new listeners every single week. So it'd be good to find out about that. But today, we're talking about mergers and acquisitions, or to put it in sort of more plain terms for people that have no idea what that means. We're talking about how to sell your store or potentially buy another store and merge it in, which is going to be quite exciting. So before we dive into all of that, Ben, do you want to give us a little overview now? What qualifies you to sit here on the podcast today speaking with us?
Sure, yeah. So apologies to those who've heard me before. I'm going to bore you with a bit of repetition.
Not at all.
I got into e-commerce in 2016. My background before that was quite different. I was an environmental advisor to oil and gas industry. So I was the token tree hugger, or dolphin hugger, to be more accurate, in the room.
Before it was cool as well.
Yeah, telling the engineers that they couldn't chuck chemicals in the sea. And I generally enjoyed my job, although I did feel like there was perhaps something missing and starting to get a bit of an entrepreneurial itch. And then something happened, which kind of was the catalyst for a complete change in trajectory for me. I got quite unwell with a heart problem. I'm okay now. But I had to take a bunch of drugs and stop work for several months and stop my fitness hobbies. So I started a fitness brand as a hobby to earn me some more pocket money. And my idea was to sell these products into gyms. And then I discovered, I could sell these online. And I had no business background, no marketing experience, and no product development experience. But I had a scientific background. So I was able to sort of not quite learn by just doing, but learn by experimenting in a scientific-ish way. Turned out I was good at it. I quit my job. I grew that business. And when I sold it in late 2019, we were doing about $6 million in top line. So 2019, that's a long time ago in e-commerce years. E-commerce years are like dog years. So it's a long time ago.
And it was the other side of COVID as well, which has changed a lot of things for all of us.
The other side of COVID, yeah. The deal closed in Halloween 2019, and COVID hit just the other side of the new year. So what qualifies me is I've been there and done it. I've sold my e-commerce business. The brokerage I used were NAF, and I was very lucky because my accountant, Alison, who's got close to 30 years M&A experience, tidied up the mess, and we got the deal done. So we did the classic entrepreneur thing. At the end of it, we said, well, let's improve on that. Let's scratch our own itch. And we created Ecom Brokers. And so we're in the UK. We do deals all over the world now. We've actually got a deal director, John, in Chicago. And our job is to help e-commerce business owners plan and then execute their exit, whether that's very soon or not for another 18 months. I'm still building brands. So I own a sports brand, or I co-own a sports brand. I co-own a parent and baby brand, and I've got equity in a few other brands as well. So I've still got my feet in the trenches. I understand what people are going through with their businesses, which I think is really important. So that's me.
Excellent. And if I'm not mistaken, Alison still works for you as well, doesn't she? Or works with you?
Alison, yeah. So Alison is my co-founder in Ecom Brokers, and she is still the director of Mint Accounting, and they are in my view, the leading accountancy firm in the UK for e-commerce. So they look after accounts for several of my businesses, my own accounts, and many, many of their clients end up coming with e-com brokers when they're ready to kind of move on and exit their business.
Nice. And I think there's always that longevity. Certainly when people come to our business, for example, or we hire them or we're working with clients, it's always nice when someone says, yeah, I've been here for 5 years or something. And you know, we've been, you know, through it all together. It shows that trust and that loyalty that you're not going to disappear overnight, which I think is always important. So I guess a really big question then, mergers and acquisitions. I said very briefly at the start about, you know, selling a business, buying a business. What's included in that process? Let's kind of uncover that before we start talking about what's changed and what's moving or what sort of direction things are moving in.
Sure. Well, you know, we're talking about mergers and acquisitions when it comes to e-commerce, which typically, you know, let's just define what we're talking about. Mostly it's physical products, brands selling on their own website, often built on Shopify, but also on marketplaces such as Amazon and Walmart and Fair and sometimes eBay and Etsy and all sorts of things like that. Very often, these are small businesses in terms of headcount. Could be very, very lean, one or two people, and then remote freelancers, for instance, or they might be much bigger. But we're not typically talking about behemoth conglomerates or anything like that. The deal size that we see is typically from a few hundred thousand up to the high teens of millions. And there's a little bit of SaaS, so some software as a service businesses get sold through us, and some agencies as well, agencies who actually work with e-commerce businesses themselves who decide that it's time to move on. So that's what we're talking about. So typically it's an e-commerce business owner decides, I've been doing this for several years, I've developed a profitable business, but for one reason or another, and there's lots of different reasons why, I'd like to look at developing my exit strategy because I want to sell very soon, or I just want to be prepared to sell when I hit specific targets, which might be in 3 months or it might be in 2 years.
And I guess what when somebody sells a business, what are the sort of things that are actually listed on that transaction? You know, you and I would call them assets. You know, what are the assets that somebody would actually be interested in buying so people can then think about how do I increase the value of them? How do I look after them? What are the important nuts and bolts here?
Absolutely. So that raises a sort of related issue, which is whether you're going to do an asset sale or a share sale, which you can talk about in a few moments. But typically speaking, if you have an e-commerce business, Nix Knitting, right? You're going to sell the Nix Knitting brand and all the intellectual property associated with that. The domains. Yep.
Logos, color schemes, domains.
All of yep. that. Your email list, your chatbot subscribers, your social media accounts, your physical inventory that you have on hand at the time of the purchase. All of that is what we're talking about. It's imagine that, you know, Nix Knitting is going to get picked up, packaged into a box with a ribbon, and taken to the office of somebody else. They're going to unwrap the package and integrate it into their existing setup if they've got one. That's what we're talking about.
A big part of that is it's basically anything the company owns.
Yes.
So one of the things that, I mean, I started a business years ago, and hindsight's a beautiful thing. I don't believe in regrets, but if I could go back, what would I change? Which is always a very good question to ask. Some of the things I would change is what the business actually owned. So I firstly would have patented our name. There were never any issues around that. But having a patent shows that if you buy this business, you own that name. And that patent is really important to that. Some of the other things I would have done is probably done a massive, I mean, I didn't sell an e-commerce business, but I would have done a massive sales drive and got as many new customers in as possible, or built databases through giving free guides away or something. Again, it was a service-based business that I sold, but it's looking at all that sort of stuff. So like the amount of inventory you're sitting on and your ability to sell that inventory is really key. If you buy your own office and warehouse, that can be both a good thing and a bad thing. That could be good because someone says, well, your warehouse and office space is worth $2 million. So that's $2 million. Before we've even looked at your Shopify store and your customers and your revenue, it's $2 billion we've got to pay for that. Sorry, 2 million, not billion, $2 million for that physical asset. So that's quite a wise thing to do in that sense. Equally, they might go, well, we're not buying it because we don't want that asset. And you don't want to be stuck with it because you've now got to sell it to someone else or find a tenant to go in it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So you could be stuck with this physical building that you can't really use. And that's therefore a problem. And it's a fixed asset. It's not liquidized. It's not cash. So you've got to think about things like that. And if you then say, well, I'm going to sell the physical building with the business and that's a requirement, you might find it takes longer to sell. So it's one of these things where you've got to really couple this up. Equally, if your e-commerce store got a shop on a very busy high street, that's what I would describe as a more relevant asset than a warehouse in the middle of nowhere that's just shipping products out. The shop now has customers that come in, it's brand awareness, and it means that advertising in your local area is more fruitful in terms of how much revenue you get through it. So the asset list, I think, is really important. And there are lots of strategic ways you can look at that and actually milk more money from it as part of a sale. But yeah, as I say, you want to make sure that none of those assets are actually putting a ball and chain around your ankle when it comes to sale as well.
Yes, you've raised an important point there, because although it can be tempting to want to have these physical assets, like you mentioned, they're like a warehouse, for instance, and this can be highly appropriate for certain businesses. It's also, you mentioned ball and chain. I think that's a great way of putting it. The smaller your business, if you're doing under probably eight figures, it's really smart to try to keep things as lean as possible in terms of the physical assets. Most buyers who are typically private equity backed organizations who want to buy your business, although we can talk about strategic purchases too, but most buyers are not going to want to get caught up in having too many physical assets like a warehouse, etc. They want to benefit from economies of scale of putting your brand into their existing setup. They've either got their own warehouses or they've got their own third-party logistics partners. And either they'll want to keep using their own third-party logistics partners or take on the relationship you have with a third-party logistics partner. But often their appetite for taking on a warehouse, for instance, is not particularly high. And similarly, their appetite for taking on the employees associated with that setup is not high. So the leaner you can keep your business, the more automated and outsourced you can keep it, the better. Having said that, buyers know that as the business gets bigger, as we start talking about a business that's doing, you know, over $1 million in profit, then the chances of it having physical assets like a warehouse are higher, because that simply is required to make the business operate smoothly. And therefore, their willingness and ability to take on those assets is higher. So it's horses for courses. It depends what kind of business you have.
And last thing I want to touch on this, which it's not like a physical asset, but it does create physical assets, which are your products. How important, I mean, it's a very loaded question. It is important, isn't it, to own your supply chain as much as you can. And we've spoken about it with a lot of merchants in the past of saying, if you're just ordering stuff on, let's say Alibaba, which is only one step up, I would say, from dropshipping. It's what I did in my store years ago. We used to just literally throw our logo on products. They arrived in a big shipping container from Alibaba, never even went to the factory. We did some quality checks to make sure they were being made ethically and no one was being hurt or injured, et cetera, et cetera. So we did a bit of a compliance check on that. But we basically ordered stuff on Alibaba and it just arrived and it had our logo on the side. It's really easy to copy that, and actually we didn't own our supply chain. So when I talk about supply chain, if you manufacture your own products, or at least you bring in raw materials and then make your own, or you buy them in from somewhere but you have a very tight secure contract with them that this manufacturer is not going to go anywhere, we have some securities like patents, etc., which mean that our products are not going to be easily copied. That's the thing I'm getting at, is because someone might say, look, I can give you $5 million for the business, or I could invest $2 million and start my own business selling an identical product.
Yeah.
What are the dangers around supply chains then? Do you agree with that? Do you think actually it's not as clear cut as that? Or do you think it doesn't really matter at a smaller scale?
Lots of things whizzing around my head there that have popped up. So you mentioned Alibaba. Nothing wrong with Alibaba, particularly to use it to find manufacturing partners, suppliers in the first instance. And what's great about Alibaba is that you can very quickly vet manufacturers, because they give you so many filters. You can filter according to the certified audits that they have submitted. You can filter according to those who've actually paid to have a top level membership with Alibaba. You can filter according to how long a manufacturer has been on there. And then you can look at the manufacturer details, head over to their own website, and then do some research as to the legitimacy of them. You know, a top tip is if you're looking at a manufacturer in China, do some sleuthing on the internet and find out if they have ever attended trade shows in Europe or the US. Because if that manufacturer can be bothered to go all the way to the other side of the world, that's pretty good evidence that they're legit, for instance. So nothing wrong with using Alibaba to find suppliers. But then it's about finding the right ones and building a relationship with them outside of Alibaba. You cannot be beholden to Alibaba in the same way I talk to people all the time about not being beholden to, say, Amazon. The second level of that, I think, is owning your intellectual property on the product. So that means you have to have trademarks surrounding your brand name. And that means that you need to have those, not just in the countries in which you sell, but also the countries in which you manufacture. For instance, China, Vietnam, Pakistan, wherever it might be. And also patents on designs. That's really important. Patents and design registrations. That means then that if something happens with your manufacturer, whatever that might be, they go out of business, their factory gets shut down, the factory goes on fire, you can shift manufacturer to somebody else. And it's probably a good idea to have that set up already. In fact, possibly always manufacture the same product with more than one supplier. That is belt and braces, but that can be a smart thing to do. So that's really important. If you're manufacturing in-house and the cost works for you, you know, you might bring in components from different manufacturers and assemble them yourself or with your team. That's got benefits because it builds the moat around your business, making it much more difficult to copy. But you also have to accept that that adds a layer of complexity, which certain buyers will not want to take on.
The employees and...
Yeah, yep. Exactly.
Yep.
An issue that I've seen several clients run into is this. They have worked with a sourcing agent. And in fact, one particular client worked with this sourcing agent in the UK. And this sourcing agent then had them over a barrel because the sourcing agent had the relationship with the manufacturer in China, would not reveal the manufacturer details to the client. The sourcing agent was the importer of record. And it effectively meant that the client always had to go through this sourcing agent. And that is not an acceptable relationship for a buyer. So it basically rendered the business unsellable.
Yep.
And in my opinion, a sourcing agent shouldn't be doing that. A sourcing agent should help you source the product once and not...
And then you own that chain.
Yeah. And then they introduce you and there shouldn't be a permanent middleman. That client has now redesigned the product and found their own supplier and owns their relationship entirely. So this type of thing is really important. I'm really glad you raised it. A lot of people get that very wrong.
The reason it came up is there's two or three businesses we spoke to in the past where I've asked this question, as in Shopify merchants, ones that are doing very well and saying, how much do you own the supply chain? One of which was from a company called Bite, which is the little hard toothpaste that as soon as you put it in your mouth, it softens. And I had a fascinating conversation with them. And she said that she lost her sense of taste at one point because she had made one that was so strong, had so much lemon in the actual ingredient. She lost her sense of taste for 2 weeks. But she owns her supply chain. No one can make the same product. And actually, her product was a complete pioneering product. No one was really selling anything like that before her, and certainly not in the way she was doing it. You can buy them at service stations in the UK. It's like a chewable toothpaste, but that's not what she was selling. It's a toothpaste that you can still use. So you can take on a flight. That was her problem that she solved, was she couldn't take, she was just buying small bits of toothpaste everywhere she flew around America. So every time she got an internal flight, can't take baggage with her because she's only going to be away for one night and her flight times mean she can't wait around for a bag to arrive. It's hand luggage only. So there's stuff like that. And then she owns that supply chain. Yeah. And equally, somebody else I asked, they said that they got an email one day just saying, we've shut the factory, sorry. And they were like 24 hours away from doing a massive, massive sales push. And therefore, we're about to order more stock. And it was like, flip, the whole business is now in jeopardy. So we're not even at the stage of merger acquisition, selling it. The whole thing now is, this is why I raised it, is it's something you don't think about initially, but actually if you plan your steps, as you say, you can use Alibaba to get the business off the ground, get those first orders and stuff through, but you might want to change manufacturers or at least then start or do your vetting in the first place. Yeah. It doesn't take long. I think your trade show's comments are genius one. I think that's really, really smart.
Yeah, so there's a couple of other things that have just come to mind on that. One is this, if your product has a mold, make sure two things. One, the contract stipulates that you own the mold. And even better, if possible, the mold is stored at a third-party location and only taken back to the manufacturer's factory when they manufacture, and then it's returned to the third-party location. This means if the manufacturer closes, you can still get to your mold. Also, in the mold, literally have your brand name and trademarked logo as part of the mold. So the product contains your name. So the manufacturer can't rip you off and start selling the product to others.
And your customers know if it's legitimate or not, because it won't include that if it's not.
Yeah. And this is really important because we talk about a model that we've got two main models that we talk about when we're helping people think about how to make their business more sellable and valuable. And the one that this one most closely relates to is something we call the value pyramid. If you imagine a pyramid of like a Mexican or a Mayan pyramid, not like an Egyptian one, of five layers. And at the bottom, you've got brand, which is there because I think that's most important. Then you've got one up from that is growth. Then you've got risk, then transferability, and then documentation. This all falls under risk. If a buyer, and that's right in the middle of the pyramid, if that layer disappears, the whole thing is going to not stand up. a buyer is not, when they're doing their due diligence, and they'll take a good 45 to 80 days when they're doing their due diligence to consider purchasing your business, they will turn over every stone. And if they determine that these issues that we're discussing now don't stand up to scrutiny and the deal is too risky for them, they won't buy your business. No matter what you think it's worth on paper because of the profit that you're making.
And I think, ironically, the people that are probably thinking this is too far-fetched for me, I've barely even got the business started, actually, you're the ones that can do the most about it with the least amount of input, I would say. It's harder when you're subscribed to, we're getting our products from this place, et cetera, et cetera. It's harder to change later. And so I would say that if you're making those decisions now based on what you're hearing from Ben, absolutely, you can get it in the right place now. That you, I think we've said on the last couple episodes we did together, Ben, as well, earlier in the year, we sort of said, like, even if you're not going to sell, always having that in mind means you run your business in a really good way. Because all these things, whether you're going to sell it or not, this is all really, like the example I shared of, you know, that particular merchant was like, yeah, we lost our entire supply chain overnight and we were low on stock at the time. So like we had to basically rebuild the whole supply chain whilst trying to maintain sales and keep customers keen and answer questions like, why aren't you doing Christmas discounts right now? Well, because you haven't got any stock. So yeah, I think doing this now just keeps the whole business, you know, in motion. It keeps it all on the way, which is good. Let's transition into what's going on then. So we've spoken very much about sort of traditional sense of merger and acquisition. And the big question I want to ask you today, the big one that you've said to, you know, for us to have a look at is, what's changing? You know, what's changed this year? What are merchants doing differently? What are buyers doing differently that we need to consider?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that I sold my business at the end of 2019. And that was right before this big explosion in buying and selling e-commerce businesses. Up until around about that point, few big e-commerce deals were being done. They were being done, but relatively few of them. In September 2018, some financial guys from New York and Boston met in a Dunkin' Donuts in Boston and had a meeting. At the end of that meeting, they formed an organization called Thrasio, Thrasio. And they were the pioneers in rolling up e-commerce businesses. They primarily focused on Amazon, but they also purchased other businesses. And now there are around 200 other organizations like them. They're known as the e-commerce aggregators, because they aggregate e-commerce brands. And it works like this. Your business and my business and Bob's business lumped together are worth more than they are separately. So if they can purchase them at a relatively low price, but which is still an appealing deal for me and you and Bob, together they're immediately worth significantly more. So they could sell them the next day for probably triple or quadruple what they paid us. But they're not going to sell them the next day. They're going to roll up all these assets, grow the business through economies of scale and improved operational capabilities, and then either sell them all on or go public. That was the idea. Then COVID hit. And the idea seemed even better because everybody was shopping. And the price that people, individuals like you and me building e-commerce businesses in their spare room, the price that we could get for our businesses was bonkers. If I'd sold my business 6 months later, I probably would have got double for it.
Yeah.
We were seeing people actually with really pretty poor businesses becoming very, very rich and suddenly thinking that they're Bill Gates. We've gone through a correction now. 2022 has been tough, but rightly so. We've gone through a correction and now prices are more representative of the true value of businesses, perhaps a little low, and then you need to sneak back up a little bit. But here's what's happened, right? Post-COVID, the shopping spree is over. So sales have been falling, but costs have been rising. We know production costs have gone up, supply and demand, factories have been shut all over the place. Shipping costs went absolutely insane. They're coming down now, thankfully.
Especially in Europe with the Suez Canal being blocked up. Oh, that didn't help.
That was bananas. Yeah, I know of somebody who had a lot of stock stuck there.
Yeah, we had a couple of clients with stuff on the ship that was stuck.
And that was just a once in a generational event. Competition gets higher, right? So there's more and more e-commerce business owners. Entrepreneurship is becoming more and more attractive. That's great. But that means there's more competition among business owners, particularly if you're selling on a platform, you know, like Amazon or Walmart, but also in the places where you're acquiring customers like Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. Then we've got the fact that the aggregators have had a big reflection. They said, we need to get our act together, because actually they've not been operating many of these businesses very well. And that's because they've lacked foresight. They thought these businesses were not real big boy grown-up businesses. This is just selling stuff on the internet, right? They're already turning a profit. If we just buy them, they'll just keep running. They're like a machine. And they struggled to hire the talent, because the talent doesn't want to work for an aggregator. The talent wants to build their own business. So as a result, the appetite for risk from the aggregators and their investors has gone down. Their appetite to pay a high price has gone down, particularly for a business with a weak brand identity, and many of these businesses were. And their appetite for buying businesses at such a high frequency has gone down. Therefore, they're much more picky, and it's no longer a seller's market, it's a buyer's market. So it's tougher. It is tougher. However, it's not too tough if you have a good brand. If you are building a strong brand that looks, feels, and behaves like a legit CPG brand, like your favorite brands that you have, whether that's brands related to your hobbies or brands related to your profession, or you know, your favorite food product brands that you have in the cupboard. If you have a business that behaves like that, then you can still sell your business for a great multiple. I like to use the Pinocchio analogy, right? Pinocchio wanted to be a real boy. You should aspire to have a real business, which means you're not selling stuff on the internet. You have a business that is underpinned by a legit brand identity.
Mm, absolutely. And I think we're different to e-com, obviously. We're an agency side, but we use the motto of let's operate as if we had 50 people, even though we've currently not got near 50 people. Because if we've got the process and things in place, as we grow, as we hire people, we've already got the processes. We don't have to keep making them, which is why, and I say this quite a lot on the podcast, our regular listeners will know this, but I feel like a lot of the guys starting businesses on Shopify right now are absolutely spoilt. It's good. Technology's improved a lot, but they're spoiled on the basis that you don't have to suddenly look at, like, you know, how am I going to code a business? I'm not a developer. So the first few transactional websites online, they were all owned by developers, because they're the only ones that can physically build the store. That was the barrier to entry, really, really high. And then things like eBay came along and changed that. You could suddenly just chuck any product you want up on eBay. And eBay have done a lot over the years to target new products as opposed to just you and I selling our old trainers or whatever. Mm. And so I think, or sneakers for all our US listeners. I think the game has changed quite significantly in that sense, which also means you've got a lower barrier to entry, more brands popping up. And then, as you say, the buyers, these aggregators that are I assume they're the most common people that are going to be interested in buying an e-commerce business, they're getting more picky, which means you need to be way more competitive. So I guess the big question then is, if people are going to behave like one of these, you know, big household, you know, kitchen cupboard type brands, what are some of the things they should be doing today? Say you've got two staff, you're doing $20,000 a month, and you think you're absolutely milking it, but you know you're only touching sort of 0.1% of your market, you know, it's tiny compared to, what are some of the things people need to be doing today to build that brand and start behaving like a more mature brand, a more grown up and sophisticated company?
Yeah, really important point, because there'll be people listening saying, yeah, but Nick, Ben, my business is going great, we're growing, everything's fine. But it could be that your business is doing just fine, but it's still not going to be attractive to a buyer because it lacks the security of a sustainable brand. Your business may well be ranking very well because you sell a particular, let's just call it a widget, which solves a problem. But the minute something might happen to disrupt whatever's driving the traffic to your sales, the water is not going into the bath faster than than it's coming out of the plug, right? And that's a problem. But if you develop a brand, so let's ask a question, what's a brand? There's lots of definitions, but my favorite is it's a suite of products that solves problems for a particular group of people. So let's just say, let's go back to the Knix knitting example, right? You develop a range of knitting accessories for knitters, as opposed to just slapping some knitting products on eBay. You develop a brand identity. Now, brand identity is branding. Well, what's branding? In my opinion, branding is how you make people feel about your brand. If people just consider that these are some widgets, then there's no loyalty. There's no guarantee they're ever going to come back to you. They just want to buy some widgets. But if you make them feel loyal, excited that their product is coming in the post, proud of your brand, maybe they'll even love your brand. They'll fiercely defend your brand. Harley-Davidson drivers have Harley-Davidson tattoos, for goodness sake.
Yeah,
then exactly. That is the longevity and sustainability that buyers are looking for. You know, remember that buyers, they want to de-risk their investment. That is what you get with a brand identity. They want growth potential. So they want your existing customers to come back. They want your existing customers to tell other people. And they want your business to be attractive to new people. How do you make it attractive to new people? That's your branding. And how do you tell new people? Well, that's your marketing. If you're just selling widgets online that happens to have ranked well on eBay and just kind of ticked along forever, you've never had to do anything, As soon as something changes, look at what happened when Google changed their algorithm, look what happened when iOS changed, then you're in trouble. But if you have a legit marketing strategy, then your brand has sustainability. It's kind of like if a tree falls over in the forest and no one's there to hear it, did it make a sound? You could have the best branding in theory, but if in practice you're not marketing your business, then no one's going to buy from you if something changes. So, you know, I mentioned asking yourself earlier about your favorite brands. What do they do? Look at what your favorite brands do and do that. Well, they learn about their customers. They build a customer avatar. They build a brand avatar that reflects that customer. And they make content that appeals to them. Helpful, compelling, engaging, free, useful information to make the potential customer know, like, and trust you. So that's a bit of a ramble about that.
I think there's so many good points in there. And I think one of the ones in particular that you struck a chord with is actually knitting. I saw a really good example of this. I'll give you the sort of use case first, and then we'll talk about what's actually going on. My mum is into knitting, and she asked my wife the other day, would you like anything for Christmas? I would like a new project. So the word project stood out to me like, okay, this is more than, you're not just buying products. This is like it's an activity. And it's something actually my wife will probably keep for many, many years. So actually there's way more to this. So suddenly you've got all these, when you talk about brand and marketing, there are all these avenues of how they can present the brand. And so I said to my mum, okay, how do we choose? Like, do we just send you an item of clothing and you'll remake it or whatever? Like, and she's like, oh, no, go on the site that I buy all my wool from and all my knitting stuff. Go on there and they have designs of stuff and you pay an extra, I think it's 50p or something, 50 cents. And you get a copy of a PDF that tells you how to knit the product. And then it's like, okay, this is now like a proper community and a proper activity. So the community then vote like, oh, this one was really difficult. This one was really easy. So for the same cardigan or something, there are like 10 different options to go for. And you can see all the reviews. And then the customers, not the business, but the customers now also rank when they've done it. So 2-3 months after they've bought one of those PDFs, they get sent an email. How would you rank that product? Is it easy? Is it difficult? Or is it somewhere in the middle? And then you can go through and go, well, I'm quite basic when it comes to knitting. This looks amazing. I'll take this one on. And you're paying an extra 50p for essentially some pixels on a screen. It's printable, but it's pixels on a screen. So you just added 50p to every order. Plus you might go for like 5 or 10 of those because they're so cheap. So now you've increased the average order value a bit. Plus it's such a good experience. You finish one and go, wow, I can see it. You're going to go back and buy another one. And not only that, I, as not even the knitter, was on their website looking for my wife. So then you got more web traffic from us looking as well and then sending links to my mum going, oh, this one looks good. That one looks good. And she said, well, that one's too easy. I need something more advanced than that. And it's the whole community.
Yeah.
The whole community part of that was so key.
And they've borderline gamified it, because once you knit the first one, you feel that sense of satisfaction. So you're going to go back. And what I think is really smart is that they've got their customers to rank the difficulty of the patterns. So it's two things in one.
It means it's authentic as well.
And it's social proof, and it's encouraging an engaged community. That business sounds like an absolute dream. So congratulations to the people who own that. Fantastic.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of it, but that's beside the point. The point is my mum knows the name and she's the customer. I'm not. I'm just the one who looks at it. And
exactly.
If I like the product she's made for my wife, I might ask her for one as well. So we'll see. But I think you're absolutely right with the brand. What I can add in, merger and acquisition is not my forte, but what I can add in is a few metrics and KPIs I think people should keep an eye on to determine the stability of that brand, both determine and monitor how big it is, how many people know about it, but also when you come to sell, it's data, it's figures you can give. Some of the things I would definitely point at, one of them is direct traffic on Google Analytics. That is direct traffic that people have just gone into, that they've opened Google Chrome or whatever browser they're using and just typed in nixknitting.com, which I don't go there, but I have no idea what that site is, but just an example. They've gone straight to it, which means they have to know what it is. So if your direct traffic was 30, 40% of your site, or you were making $50,000 a month just with direct traffic, that's $50,000 a month of brand revenue, as far as I'm concerned, because they know what it is. Second thing I would definitely recommend looking at is using something like Google Keyword Planner. Don't use Google Trends. I'll do a whole episode on Google Trends if people want. Don't use Google Trends. It just gives you a percentage compared to what you're looking at. Google Keyword Planner, which is a free tool. You just need a Google account or a Google Ads account to view it. You don't even have to turn that account on. You don't have to spend any money. Google Keyword Planner will tell you how many people are typing in your brand name. So I could type in Nick's Knitting Shop and it would tell me how many people are Googling that, and I would keep an eye on that. I'd write that figure down in one of my marketing reports every month and go, is that increasing? So is all my brand awareness on social and across display advertising and my customers telling their friends right now? Those are two metrics you can look at to go, what's my branding doing right now? And the third one I think is really important, which is probably something you guys look at, I imagine, quite a lot more detail, Ben, when looking at a business, is looking at the lifetime value or the repeat orders or the frequency of orders. Basically, look at how much your long-term customers are spending. What percentage of all customers are your long-term ones? What percentage of revenue come from your long-term ones? And what do the repeat orders look like? Something you touched on earlier, Ben, that we say this to clients quite a lot, and I think it's a really important point to re-emphasize, is if Facebook changed something, if all your marketing went down, if you ran out of cash and you couldn't afford to pay for advertising right now, what impact is that going to have? And that's a security bit. So actually, if it's only going to knock 20% off the top, then you might actually go, why are we advertising? Maybe we should change the way we're advertising right now. Because actually it's only putting a bit on the top and we could do without that right now, or we could use it more effectively and more long-term building brand as opposed to just going for those bottom of funnel, someone's ready to buy and chuck them straight through the cart. Could we reach more people for the same budget without having that bottom of funnel thing? So
yeah.
Okay. There's a lot in there, Ben. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, lots of important things there. One of the interesting things you raised there is if you cut your marketing spend, you might decrease, or you will, very probably, decrease your top line and your bottom line, but your margin potentially is going to be impacted favorably, which then opens you up to other buyers who said, well, this is quite good, but the margin's not right for us. And that's really important. You know, we will look at everything you said. We'll look at recurring customer rate. We'll look at average order value. We'll look at cost per acquisition. Most importantly, we will look at profit, which I'm going to call profit for the purposes of this podcast. In actual fact, we look at something called seller's discretionary earnings, but that's getting a bit too technical. So for the purposes of a back of an envelope calculation, we'll look at profit. That's the bottom line, literally. But all of those metrics that you mentioned are important. And, you know, top line sales is very important, but it is a bit of a vanity metric. And people need to be aware of that.
Absolutely. And look, we'll bring things into land now, but I think as a final question, and I think it's a really important one, we touched this a little bit. If someone's sitting there going, right, Ben, Nick, I've listened to this whole episode. I am not interested in selling, but it's all been quite useful. What are some of the things they can do without just fully going, right, there's everything. There's that golden, you know, that golden box with the red ribbon you mentioned at the start. What are the other options if they go down this road of running their business like this?
Yes. I mean, you mentioned this earlier about how if you run your business as if you're going to sell it, it suddenly becomes a heck of a lot of an easier business to run. It's far more efficient. It's a slick, well-oiled machine. You feel less overwhelmed. You can concentrate on the things that actually grow your business rather than getting bogged down in the nitty-gritty. There's a model that we use for this. It's called the 7 Foundations of Value. There's an article about that on our website. And these are the 7 things that sellers ought to be, or business owners ought to be thinking about. Yes, as they build to sell their business, but even if that's either not on their agenda or it's in their very long-term agenda, the happy side effect of doing these 7 things will make your business grow faster and bigger. So that those things are timing, which is thinking about selling your business when it is growing, but you haven't maxed out growth and you've left opportunity for the potential buyer. That your business is stable. So that means you're selling in a favorable niche, no fads, no highly regulated products. You're not dabbling in black hat strategies. Your business is very transferable. Your business is very well documented. You've got meticulous record keeping. So somebody could ask you, I want product X from 2 years ago, and you can make it appear very quickly. And within that, we'd say, you know, you've documented all your systems and processes in an operations manual. So you can hand over an operations manual to a potential new owner and say, there you go, that's how to run my business. There's defensibility, which we've spoken a lot about today in terms of having a strong brand identity protected by intellectual property. Diversification. So every part of your business should be diversified to protect you so that you don't have all your eggs in one basket. So your sales channels are several. You're selling in several different international markets, or your business at least has the potential to expand to international markets. You're not reliant on one or two hero products, which are taking up far too high a proportion of your revenue and profit. And you're not reliant on only one or two traffic sources. Then there's suppliers. We spoke about those earlier, but your relationship with your supplier is important, and you have to make sure your suppliers are completely legit in terms of their quality and their credentials. And finally, there's efficiency. A buyer wants to buy an efficient, well-oiled machine, and even if you don't want to sell, your business needs to be an efficient, well-oiled machine. What would you rather have, an efficient engine or one that you have to wind up yourself every morning? And so that involves building the systems and processes that we spoke about, but also automation where you can, and outsourcing what you can to for instance, agencies, and using it, building a team to take care of the nitty-gritty day-to-day so you can concentrate on moving the needle and growing your business and not putting out fires.
Whilst keeping it lean as well. Not employing everybody you can, but employing just the people you need.
Exactly.
Nice. Well, Ben, final question. How can people get in touch and where can they find that article? Because that article sounds like a very, very good piece of reading for this evening.
Sure, yeah. So you can get in touch by emailing me, ben@ecombrokers.co.uk. It's a UK domain, but we operate all over the world. You can get that article at ecombrokers.co.uk and then just click on blog. You can watch a video about it if you want, ecombrokers.co.uk/YT for YouTube. And you can even listen to it at ecombrokers.co.uk/pod.
Lovely stuff. Ben, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And for everybody else listening at home, we'll be back again next week. As always, apologies. I keep saying we post every Friday. We've missed a couple recently. There's been a couple of Monday posts. Apologies. And we're planning into next year. So as I said right at the start, do reach out if you want to chat. Apart from that, have an amazing week. We're back again next Friday. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. You can subscribe to our weekly newsletter for exclusive offers at winningwithshopify.com. And don't forget to check out our Facebook group by searching for Winning with Shopify on Facebook. Over and out.